Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. Hi everyone, thanks for joining us on another episode of the Treasures from Malta podcast. It is my great pleasure to introduce Keith Beras.
Hi Fran.
Keith, you've made art history the vocation of your life. Since graduation decades ago, you've worked tirelessly in researching, discovering, publishing, and lecturing about various aspects of the art history of Malta. Your name is synonymous with the Baroque period, and most particularly, that holy trinity for Malta, the painters Caravaggio and Mattia Preti, and the famous Maltese sculptor of the Roman Baroque, Melchiorre Gaffa. You are presently professor and head of the Department of Art and Art History at the University of Malta, and the books to your name just keep growing. Keith, what is it about art history that excites you?
My dear friend, thank you so much. The decades ago worries me, because suddenly you realize that time is passing so quickly, and art history became my life at a very young age, and largely due to my family. My father was a keen lover of art, so somehow it got into my blood at a very young age. At the age of 16 or 17, in the late 1980s, I decided to follow art history as a sort of academic field of study. When the study of art history as an academic discipline in Malta was still non-existent, or still in its very, very, very early years, and that makes it feel like decades ago, from, because when we see where we are today, we have hundreds of graduates over the past 20 or 30 years, and these graduates now fill most of the important posts in scholarship, in education, museums, and galleries, and the museum world in itself.
Whenever there is a major international conference or exhibition or publication on Caravaggio studies, your name features prominently. What got you to make Caravaggio one of your principal research interests? And don't you ever get fed up of him?
That's the problem. Now, Caravaggio is it has turned into this great brand, kind of brand name. It's a name that fascinates, and fortunately, he's been riding the wave now for over 6 or 7 decades. Caravaggio mania hit the streets in the early 1950s. It reached an early peak in the late 60s, and now it just keeps on peaking and peaking and peaking. But I must say that when we started off in the late 1980s or the early 1990s, nothing was really known about Caravaggio's final years. Nothing was really known about Caravaggio's Malta, or about Caravaggio's Sicily. And even if you get to read the major biographies or publications on the artist, it was all about Caravaggio's Rome. We're blessed, know that we have the oratory of the Decollato in Valletta, which houses two of his most extraordinary works. Certainly, the beheading qualifies as being one of the most extraordinary works. And it takes me back to when I was a teenager, once again, my dad, perhaps, and standing there in front of the picture, which we called Il Caravaggio, I remember when I started my PhD, initially I wanted to do my PhD on Caravaggio, but I was dissuaded by everyone. Everyone means everyone. Why? Because it was a little bit of a challenge, and because everybody was studying Caravaggio, until you realize that we knew almost nothing, very, very little, about the context of him in Malta, and very little about his patrons, because it's all about the context of the artist. Why did he come to Malta? Who were those who celebrated him? Who were those who commissioned his works? Who were those who helped him? Who were those who ultimately bestowed him with a knighthood, when in actual fact they should have arrested him and sent him as a present to the Pope, because he was, as all know, a fugitive from Papal Rome. So these are the questions that you ask at the age of 20 that would seem impossible to find an answer to, but then gradually, slowly, you start building your hypothesis through data that you find, and then you realize that you've got enough data to put forward arguments. Well, obviously, Fran, you do not do these on your own. There's always someone who believes in you, who pushes you, and who perhaps introduces you to key players who will then perhaps also believe in you and introduce you to other key players. So that's the story of a scholarship. I was very, very lucky to have Professor Mario Buhagiar as my first supervisor. He is the person who placed art history on an academic footing on the island. And the one thing about Mario Buhagiar is that he embraced research of all types. And he is that kind of person who pushes you, but pushes you to an extreme. He makes you work.
You've touched upon archives, and when we think about it, one of Malta's greatest unsung treasures are our many archives, and they survive and they are accessible, which is key for researchers. For us art historians, they are our primary source, along with, obviously, works of art. Is there still hope that more can be discovered? For example, in the field of Caravaggio studies, you have made great discoveries on Caravaggio in our archives. Is there more to be discovered, do you think?
I'm sure that there is. Look, we are blessed as scholars of the 17th and the 18th century, one, because of the extraordinary wealth of cultural heritage that we have in terms of painting, sculpture, architecture, and decorative arts. This is your field, don't Fran? So we are truly blessed. But more than that, we are doubly blessed because we have extraordinary archives, and in many ways, these archives will provide the context for connoisseurship. So art history is about connoisseurship, is about looking at works and understanding who produced them, when they were produced, or where they were produced. It's about technical art history, understanding the technique and the materiality of the work. But it's also about contextual analysis. It's about history or art historical context. And this, more than anything else, you get from the site where the work is. So if the work is in the oratory of the Decollato, or in a particular church, or in a particular palace, what does the palace tell you? And from the archives. The archives require, you know very well, they're painful, but that's a drug. It is truly a drug, because once you get into it, it won't let you go. Once you have a research question, the fact that you're trying to uncover something, that you're building points of contact, that you feel lost, completely lost when you start off. These thousands of volumes that you have to read when one unlocks the mystery, the Caravaggio documents that I had discovered, or documents relating to Melchiorre Gaffin. The thrill of the find is extraordinary. I remember when I found the Caravaggio document in 2000 or 2001 at the Biblioteca in Valletta, I just couldn't believe it. One, I knew that I was so close. So something told me that I was homing in.
I'm going to stop you right there and take you back one. Can you explain what you found, what it is that made all the difference for Caravaggio's studies?
I mean, there were many issues about Caravaggio. One of the main issues was what led to him falling in disgrace. So we have this extraordinary, in Malta, we have this extraordinary story of a fugitive who turns up in Malta. Instead of being arrested and sent as a present to the Pope, he is celebrated. He was celebrated. He was tasked to paint. He painted a portrait of the Grand Master himself, possibly two portraits of the Grand Master. He painted paintings for major knights, including the Admiral, including the Prior of Messina. And then he was made a knight of Malta, notwithstanding the fact that the statutes did not allow the Grand Master to make him a knight, so he had to get the Pope to give him permission, made a knight, and then suddenly he was thrown in prison, jailed, and then he escaped. So one of the many questions that we were trying to answer is the reasons why Caravaggio fell into disgrace. Remember, this was the first time that the Knights of Malta were bestowing this knighthood to an artist. So it was, I describe it as one of the most humanist moments in the story of European art, not in the story of Maltese art, because this was one of the first times that this happened. So the why he fell into the disgrace became the big question mark. And I was trying to home into that for a couple of years. And then the document was there, meaning there was this brawl and there was this, the other knights were involved, a pistol was used, a shot was exploded, a count with this wonderful name, Conte Giovanni Rodomonte Roerio, Conte della Vezza di Asti. The name could not end, like it took two lines. He fell wounded to the ground. So there was this tumult, and then all these knights escaped. The front door of the house of the organist was smashed open. So it's a wonderful story at the end of the day. The narrative is so beautiful. And Caravaggio was the first to be identified as the sort of ringleader, and the first to be arrested, and the first to be detained in Fort St. Angelo. So when you really home into that, the thrill was extraordinary. I remember reading his name, and in the end, I just couldn't believe it. So I got up, I went down to Piazza Regina, went to have a coffee just in front of the library, called a friend. I'm not quite sure whether we had mobiles. And we had, in 2001, I think, I don't know how. And I told him to come back up with me, and we went up to the library again. I told him, look, can you read this, please? This is the thrill of archival research, meaning sometimes I say, what is the greatest thrill, that the discovery of a work of art or the discovery of a document? Just like when our dear friends from the notarial archives in Valletta, meaning I was working on this Francesco Noletti, this very important still life painter, Maltese, and we just couldn't get Noletti in Malta, the name Noletti in Malta. So I had asked our friends at the notarial archives to keep an eye open. And literally 2 or 3 days later, the Feferisa, Zamiflupi, and Dr. Giona Vera called me in and yelling, ah, we found this Noletti business boiled down to the identification of a painter that was all based on 2 engravings that were published in France in 1703. And the corpus all boiled down on one of them, on the discovery of one of them, which remains sort of. And I remember walking into a very random house in Rabat some 20 years ago, asked by an auctioneer to go with him so that he sees the catalogs, the works that were coming up for auction. And there in front of you, you find the painting that you had been looking for decades, and where your hypothesis then becomes a fact.
We've sung the praises of Maltese archives, and we could spend our life and several other lifetimes exploring them and discovering more. But you have also researched in major libraries and archives abroad, including some very inaccessible ones. Can you mention the ones that were hardest to get into?
The hardest to get into, now they are more and more accessible, okay? So let me be clear. But in the late 1980s and early 90s, some archives were very, very difficult. So if we take Rome, and here I must give due credit to Fra John Chrétien, who was then conservator of the palace, magistrate palace, SMOM in Rome, but the archives of the Knights of Malta in the palace in Rome, in Via dei Condotti, was something that was still kept as archivio segreto. So archivio segreto means archives that is used only for internal purposes rather than for the scope of research. And it was through Grandmaster Andrew Barty that was open. So the fact that one was the first in, then that gives you the opportunity to sift through the tons and tons of letters, of correspondence, of data sheets. And there we discovered so many new details on the works of art for St. John's. But not only there, the Vatican secret archives, the archives of the Reverenda Fabrica di San Pietro, the archives of the banks in Naples. These are extraordinary ledger books that unfortunately now they have been closed. My PhD supervisor, Dr. Jennifer Montague, is the leading scholar of 17th century sculpture in Rome, and she was very much interested in the industry of the art. So when we go into a major church or monument, and we see, let's take St. John's, for example, and there's the baptism of Christ on the titular altar, with a 5-meter statue, marble statue of Christ, and another 5-meter marble statue of John the Baptist. And the one thing that you have to come to terms with is, how on earth did it get there? How did they lift it? How did they get it there from Rome? How did it manage to get there? How long did it take? What were the expenses involved? Then you realize, through the discovery of contracts and whatever, that the sculptor Melchiorre Gaffar, who was first asked to do it, was actually made contractually to build a full-scale model of the apse of the Church of St. John's in Rome. Now, can you imagine that today?
And do we know where it was placed in Rome?
The biographer Baldinucci, in 1681, when he speaks about Melchiorre Gaffar, and he said, Melchiorre Gaffar passed away, etc., etc. And he says, at one point, he says, ah, what a pity, he says. His full-scale models for Malta are still in the Vatican Foundry. So they were in the Vatican Foundry by 1681. And when one gets to terms with what was required, what was required to get those marble blocks from Carrara, to take them all the way down to Livorno, from Livorno to Civitavecchia, from Civitavecchia placed on a barge, taken up the Tiber, the River Tiber, to what is known as the Ripetta, in the heart of Rome. That Mazzuoli, who later carved them, had a warehouse close to the river, that he carved them there. Then the correspondence between the ambassador and the Grand Master on how they were to transport them. The Grand Master insisting that they were to be placed on the galleys, because the galleys were the destroyers, no? The galleys were fortified and they were fast. So they take them to carved. They take them back to Civitavecchia. When the galleys arrive, they realize that they do not fit in the hold. Captain of the galleys refused to take them on board because if he took them on board, he had to remove 3 rows of benches. So there is this ambassador who writes to the Grand Master to tell him what's happening. And then he tells him, okay, I have a tartana, I have a barge, a cargo carrier. We can place them in the cargo carrier. But the cargo carrier is slow, and the tract of sea between Sicily and Malta was the Sea of Corsairs. So obviously there you will get your corsairs. Gradually, you literally get this picture of the industry of the art. And when you walk into St. John's and you have this data that you know how difficult, how painstaking it was, that adds another dimension. One of the most beautiful letters that I've come across is in the Archivio, the National Archives of Florence. And it's a letter from La Valette to the Duke during the Great Siege. And at one point he's telling him, look, this is not going, we're not going to last long.
A desperate call for help.
Meaning you have desperate. You have to, and when you have this letter in your hands, you can picture the entire desperate call for help. And there are similar letters in the Archivio Segreto Vaticano, but also in other major archives across the continent.
How incredibly moving. Yes, all this is so interesting, but you need a lot of time and you need to collaborate with other people as well. This brings me around to the idea that you've actually rubbed shoulders with the great and the good in all this time.
And the bad.
Let's not mention the bad. There's enough of that around. Can I get you to name some names?
In a local context, clearly, Mario Bohaja. He shaped or anchored me in a scholarly discipline. And that is the most important thing. Internationally, there are many. When it comes to Baroque sculpture, then that is Jennifer Montague. Jennifer Montague was the keeper of the Warburg library, photographic library, before Google was invented. So before the search by photo, the search by photo thing, you had to go to a phototeca. Simple. And there was no way, other way of doing it. You either go to Rome or to Florence, and there were, or to Bologna or to London, work in these photographic archive libraries where they had archives, photography, photos of hundreds and hundreds of work. So what today I tell my students, you complain because the download speed is 0.1 seconds and you just search Algardi by image and in 0.11 seconds you get it. In terms of Caravaggio studies, I must say that the man who really gave me the first platform was Nicola Spinoza, who was then the superintendent of Naples, major scholar on 17th century Neapolitan art, Caravaggio, Ribera, Luca Giordano, and Mattia Preti. And the thing is that they were working at the onset of this great Caravaggio, the Final Years exhibition that was a joint effort between the Metropolitan Museum, New York, the National Gallery in London and the Capo di Monte in Naples. And at the onset of it, Nicola Spinoza somehow believed, and this moment he's 28-year-old, I remember there was this Italian ambassador, Riccio, who was a keen art lover in the, I think, late 1990s. And he used to follow my lectures. And then one weekend he had Nicola Spinoza as a guest over at his residence in Tashbish, and he invited me over. And that was perhaps one of the most important moments in my career as a Caravaggio scholar, because Nicola Spinoza then literally almost assigned me with the task of coordinating the final years phase, the Sicily and the Malta phase, for this great exhibition that had been projected for 2004. So it was a 5-year project, which included the Metropolitan Museum and the National Gallery in London. This was the exhibition that it was a real blockbuster show. It apart from the numbers, it was critically received in an extraordinary manner, and it won the Apollo, the International Exhibition of the Year award. And the fact that the curators then had asked me to deliver the first inaugural lecture was in a way a recognition of the work that we had done. And that exhibition placed the final years in the map of Caravaggio studies. Nowadays, it seems to me as though the final years became almost more interesting, more exciting, more than the Roman years. Then that led to the senior fellowship at the Metropolitan. It led to tasks and lectures in major museums, and that sort of then consolidates the role of a player in Caravaggio mm-hmm. studies. Mm-hmm.
And this brings to mind that you've actually published several books and scholarly articles where you're presenting to the public and to the academic community the results of your research. And your research has been far beyond Caravaggio and Gaffa and Noletti and Preti, of course. You've even published with Fondazione Patrimonio Malti or early publications.
My first one.
So that's nice. It started with Patrimonio. But what are you working on next?
Caravaggio is a man who haunts me. I have published many essays on Caravaggio in numerous academic journals, exhibition catalogues, and all. But if you read my CVs repeatedly over the years, there's always this thing that he's working on the Caravaggio book. It's 10 years delayed, if not 20 years delayed, because there's so much that still needs to be done. So what am I working on at the moment is the Caravaggio book. I'm almost there now. I'm comfortable about the hypothesis. I'm comfortable about the data. There are a number of interesting observations, and it collates almost 1995, 25 years of research, or 26 years of research. So that's the major thing. Then there's Noletti. So there's, again, this other great thing. Noletti, there was this Maurizio Marini, very, very important scholar, very good friend of mine. We disagreed on all his attributions on Caravaggio, but we were great friends. So
the friendship survived despite the disagreement.
We despised each other's work, but we loved each other. And it was Maurizio Marini who, I think it was in 1996, I had met him for the first time in Rome, who kept always told me, ma chi è questo Maltese? Who is this Maltese Francesco Maltese Fieravino? Ma chi è questo? Chi? And every time we meet, he has this, chi è questo? Dammi nome, chi è? And that is what threw me as a, not as a side, working on still life and on the carpet paintings of Francesco Moletti, who then turned out to be one of the major, major players. Unfortunately, just like Melchiorre Gaffa, he died young, but he revolutionized the Natura Morta still life painting in Rome.
Speaking about disagreements between scholars, have you ever disagreed with yourself? I mean, have you revised an opinion about something you wrote? And how do you backtrack with grace?
Yes, look, the thing is this. The speed of research is so fast. And one thing about scholarship is what we call humility. The most important thing is that you are convinced when you write something that you are on the right track. But obviously, if you have a hypothesis and you are building the hypothesis, you have to be aware that at one point in 10 years' time, in 2 years' time, in 20 years' time, you might need to give it up. And the pitfall in art historical scholarship, in any scholarship, is that you transform or translate a hypothesis into a fact. If you write about something as though it is a fact when it is not. So I did revise some thoughts, my thoughts on Mattia Preti, and even if one sees the catalogue that I have published now, the recent book, Mattia Preti, Life and Works, and you compare it with Triumphant Manner or the earlier one, there are dates of works that are different. Restoration, so whilst, for example, there's the altar painting, that extraordinary altar painting at Sigiri by Mattia Preti, which I had published as Preti and Workshop, and at one point I said, sembra Workshop more than Preti. When we restored it, layers and layers and layers of grime and overpaint and overpaint and overpaint, meaning one is just removing these layers and the extraordinary brushwork that was hidden. Yeah, so what do you do? We should say, Lami, this is by a Preti. And that is the beauty. Yes, in Melchiorre Gaffa and Moletti, the hypothesis, now they hold ground, even though, I must say, even though there's not a single signed work by Moletti, so there's always the terror inside you that this corpus of 62 works that you have built might one day...
Somebody might
come up with a signed Francesco Noli, which is completely different too. But you test it on acceptance by scholarship. And Noletti, the first hypothesis was published in 2004, so now it's been 18 years, the corpus has grown, and it has been accepted by everyone, not only scholars, but also the antiquarian world. And that is important, because the antiquarian world, that's where then money starts coming in. And that is where. So, yes, that has been accepted. Fran, let's face it, there's always this fear somewhere that the Melchiorre Gaffa that you have attributed or ascribed might turn out to be something else. So,
on that not quite happy thought, we can meditate further and we'll take a break. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, art historian Professor Keith Shiberas. And we're back. Pictures and links are on the podcast section at www.patrimonio.org. And don't forget to give us a follow on the Treasures from Malta podcast pages on Facebook and Instagram. Keith, art historians do a range of things, not just research and publications, which we've talked about extensively. Art historians do things like curating, and you have curated a number of exhibitions, both great and small. For example, one that springs to mind is in 2017, you curated, in collaboration with us, with Fondazione Patrimonio Malti, a very focused exhibition, which was called The Devil of the Brush. We held it at Palazzo Falson, and basically the whole theme of the exhibition was this idea that you had, which was to explore the concept of speed in the execution of an artwork. And on that occasion, you selected a number of artworks for display that really made this point from the 17th century onwards. But of the exhibitions that you've curated, what has been the most challenging exhibition you put on and why?
The speed exhibition was certainly one that was fun because it was a sort of niche, small, wonderful, wonderful exhibition with small works of art. So it did not require grand spaces. Some of the works were very delicate. So remember the Mercurio da Fas terracotta. Without any doubt, the largest and most important exhibition was the Mattia Preti exhibition tra Caravaggio e Luca Giordano that we held in 2012 at the Regia, at the Palace, La Venaria Palace in Torino, with over 60 monumental works. So this had works that were 5 meters wide that we brought from all over the world, so including transatlantic. So we had three that were sent from the States. We had large works from London and from all over the continent. So yes, that had one. Yes, we mentioned the bad deal. I curated that with the very controversial figure, a very good friend of mine, even though I do not always agree with what he says and does, and that's Vittorio Sgarbi. We have this extraordinary, again, love, sometimes hate relationship, but we manage somehow to work together, and we've worked on a number of projects, including Caravaggio, but especially the largest was this Mattia Preti exhibition, because he was the Presidente del Comitato Nazionale di Mattia Preti. Logistics, well, it was a project that took some 3 years to materialize. So in terms of research, it had on-the-ground research, because in an exhibition, one needs to show the major masterpieces, the works that one expects to see, the iconic. And when you have an artist like Mattia Preti, who worked in grande on a large scale, then visitors would expect to see in grande these works. And an exhibition gives you the opportunity, even if works are very famous, to place works side by side. So you create these, what the Italians call paragoni. So you get major, major large works by the artist or by artists who influenced him. So we got works by Guercino, works by Caravaggio, Bartolomeo Manfredi, Ribera, Lanfranco, and place them thematically in paragons next to other great works by Mattia Preti. But it also requires, exhibitions always require that something new, that work that is either very difficult to see because it belongs to the most difficult of private collectors who will not even let his children in, let alone. So that key work that has been published and published and republished, but that nobody has really seen in person. Or
did you manage?
Yes. So that those are the key words that one wants. Or the new words. So you need to pearl new attributions. You need to have this beautiful mix of what we call key words and words that are loved and that are iconic. So people, the audience can remember Mattia Preti. Okay, in Malta, Mattia Preti is an icon, an icon, an icon, an icon. But in Italy, he's one of 20 great, 30 great artists. So you need the icons, you need the great words and the new ones. And we had made numerous discoveries because what happened then was that we started to get the office, the central office, got inundated by calls or requests from collectors to see their works. So in Milan we found works, we found in Torino, we found all over Italy, and some of the works were in reality groundbreaking works. Difficulties, yes, it had its own difficulties, but largely because of the scale of the works. The Palazzo di Reggia della Venaria is a major Savoy palace, so the halls are large. But then you realize at one point that these works, bring them in, you need to get scaffold and to bring them in through the balcony on the second or the third floor. Third, actually.
Stopping moments.
So again, they had to build this scaffolding with proper lifts, so works are very easily taken in and out easily with all the, but there are specialist hoarders, they have very good registrars and handlers, so that was one thing that at the end of the day you coordinate, and that's it. But then you have to wait for the critical reception.
Yes, I mean, this is a testing ground for the new attributions. First of all, the attributions are being given by the co-curators in this case in the exhibition, and you have to see whether these proposals are accepted by the academic community, which is
that is why some exhibitions are tend to be groundbreaking because of what they present together with the works that are truly established.
Have you had any surprises, like when you bring in a work of art which you think will work very, very well with the other one that you've projected to display side by side, and it just doesn't work, or you feel let down when you see the original in situ, you know, contrast against all these
exceptions? The beauty of the Regia La Venaria was that they were so up to scratch. So they had these digital models, they had but then, in reality, when you place the work, one thing that really changes is that if one work is restored by restorer A, who applies this kind of varnish, one work was restored by restorer B 20 years ago with different kind of varnish, and you say, okay, this goes there and that goes there on digitally. But then when you really see them in real life, then you have to change, make changes, but changes that fit within the context. I was very happy with that show, very, very happy, and we had no major surprises. There was, yes, at one point, there was in Genova, there a tragedy had there was this thing where a ship, I think it was a cargo ship, sailing into the harbor, had literally crashed into the port house, the port tower, and two or three guys had perished. But the harbor closed. The harbor closed when behind it there was one ship that carried three of our paintings.
Oh,
so the ship was derailed to Livorno, so we had to derail everything from Genova to Livorno. So these are the difficulties that one gets in this kind of
Okay. Mm. So even in the 21st century, travel by sea can be perilous.
Yes.
But let me bring you back to Malta. You've recently been involved in the studying, conservation and redisplay of the historic karst collection at the old university.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about this newly opened gypsotheque.
Look, we have the University of Malta, fortunately, in it, historically, it can truly anchor itself in what is considered now to be the golden age of caste culture. What is this golden age of caste culture? It's a caste culture that comes through the Enlightenment, that was perhaps born in the 18th century, but then that spread widely like wildfire in the mid-19th century, when major academies and some universities and many museums started acquiring casts, plaster casts of famous statues, plaster. So these are casts done from original molds of famous sculptures from antiquity. So you get the Torso Belvedere, the Apollo Belvedere, the Antinude, the Scopolos from the Renaissance. Therefore, you can get works by Donatello, by Michelangelo from the 17th century, works by Canova from the late 18th. And this spread, especially in Germany, but also in Italy, France, the UK, and the US. Malta and the University of Malta literally immersed itself in this caste culture at a very early stage. And the University of Malta, through its Scuola del Disegno, possessed or obtained a collection of casts, original casts from original molds. So they were very prized. So you get the statue, which could either be at the Museo Pio Clementino or at the Museo Capitolini or elsewhere, and you're given permission to create a mold of it. And then you cast from that mold, not cast from cast. So the university possesses a unique collection of such casts from one of the major cast makers of the period, Michele Gherardi.
When did they acquire these casts?
I believe that they were acquired between 1880 and 1910. We do not have the exact date. We have they're all signed, they all have a brass plate, and we have old images, old photographic images of the interior of the university of 1915 that show them in place.
Okay, what about student drawings? Because they were acquired for students.
Yes.
Study.
There are student drawings, but if you get a student drawing, there's a drawing by Giuseppe Cali of the Dying Gaul, but you're not quite sure whether it's a drawing of that cast or a print or another smaller casts.
I see the problem. I see.
So what happened is that we had this collection, but then in the 1930s and the 1940s, internationally, these casts were put aside. There were some major collections that were actually sold off. Others placed, not anymore, internationally. Others placed for storekeeping, safekeeping, and broken, dismantled, and whatever. The Maltese collection moved through the School of Art, then it moved back to university, then back to the, and somehow it dispersed, and then at one point, we decided, and this was 3 or 4 years ago, to restore, which is conserve. So it was a proper restoration, conservation intervention, and redisplay.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of it is that there is an international now re-interest, rediscovery of these gypsotechs.
It's so right on time. Well right done, you. Time.
We have between us a university, as when we meet for conferences and whatever, we sort of brag. If a university has a gypsotech, then that means that that university is a historic university and a university of importance, and that that department was historically grounded. So, and I had discussed this with a rector, that this is something that anchors. And so we've built this. More than that, it forms part of a wider program that we have, and that is the restoration and conservation of the Valletta campus, which is the historic seat of the university. Remember, we have a university that goes back to the late 16th century, instituted as a Jesuit college in the 1590s. Then it brought together a number of schools that were institutes that belonged to the Knights, including the famous School of Anatomy and Surgery that the Knights had, the School of Mathematics, and the School of Navigation that the Knights had. And when Grandmaster Pinto in the 1760s expelled the Jesuits from Malta, he took hold of the property and instituted it as the University of Malta, and brought together these other institutes. So we have a holding which is historic, and we also have a brilliant collection of portraits of academics of the 19th century and of the early 20th century by important Maltese artists, and an extraordinary portrait collection of uomini illustri. We've restored those, and we're collating also the let's call it random collections of modern art that we have, inventories, cataloging, and we're organizing galleries and securing donations.
That's exactly what I was going to ask you. You've recently secured some really important collections, some donations from Professor England, and also from the Kalea family.
Those are the two most important ones. We are working on others, but we secured a corpus, an extraordinary corpus, of over 700 concept drawings, architectural drawings, in terms of not technical,
but they're actually artistic.
Artistic concept drawings of major architectural projects by Richard England, and that is something that is truly, truly extraordinary. And Joseph Kalea, and we have others that we are working with. But the idea is to turn Valletta Campus, it is also a teaching institute and a research institute, but implant within it a number of galleries of art. And that the library there will also function as the place where these drawings and graphics are preserved and made available for research. And I wish to underline here that everything will be made available for research and free to download, high resolution images, free accessibility for research and availability for all.
Excellent. That is very good news. The Gypsotheca is already open to the public, though.
Anyone who wishes to visit the Valletta campus is most welcome, most welcome to do so.
In the last decade, you have headed the History of Art Department at the University of Malta, having been handed the baton by its founding father, Professor Mario Bohajar. Since then, you've included fine arts in the program, and the decorative arts are now being given increasing prominence, and I thank you for that. Where would you like to steer the department? And if you had no restrictions on budget or direction, what's your dream for the department?
My dream is that, yes, we need professionally oriented graduates, but we also need graduates who have that creative impulse that they can just move and bridge through specializations because they are trained to do so. And once you have a cohort of graduates, a large cohort of graduates who can do this, then change happens automatically. It happens automatically. You don't need to be an activist to do it because change happens automatically. So where do we stand as a department? Meaning we try to work to engage with their intellect. I wish, and I tell them, I tell my students, I wish that at the end of the day, my examination questions will all have one word, right. Right. And not have, this is my problem with the university bureaucracy, that we need to have the objectives and the aims and the assessment criteria. And then my wish is that the model question is just one word, right. We have, yes, identified niche areas for Mediterranean study, and you mentioned the decorative arts, meaning the Mediterranean is such an extraordinarily rich basin for the decorative arts. We're still scraping the, you know this, because yours was one of the first academic dissertations on jewelry. So, and it's not just Malta, or let's call it the Western world, but the richness of it all goes beyond the parameters of nationalities. It's throughout the Mediterranean basin. So we've identified the decorative arts. We have a program for the study of the medieval period, because Malta is okay, rich in 17th century and 18th century, but extraordinary also in it, and in the vernacular. We have a program for the modern and the contemporary, because yes, we need resources, we need large studios. Well, my dream is to have large studios for our students, to have photographic laboratories, to have opportunities for immersive art, immersive installations, and where they can exhibit their work, to have Erasmus helps greatly, so that they can travel. And we have consolidated the fine arts, but we need the parents to encourage students to take up the creative areas of research. Yes, the stakeholders should realize this, and that the creatives are not there for volunteering. Creativity should be placed on a pedestal and should be remunerated accordingly.
The department has worked a lot on this. You actually in placing students with potential employers.
Fondazione Patrimonio Maltese is one of our most important stakeholders. Frank, you know that because, and look, you and your team make our students feel special.
Well, it's a symbiotic relationship because we need people to work with us, and we obviously look to the History of Arts Department and for students who come out ready trained from university. On that positive note, we'll close off the podcast, but not before I tell you thank you very much for sharing your thoughts and your time with us.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.